39 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert from Root Bike Win, and I am really excited about the interview that she has planned for today and the very, very special guest whom she has invited to the program. First of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
And I'm sure you're very happy that we have Jennifer Phillips Vandenberg with us. Tell our listeners about who she is and how you know about her and the work she does.
Well, luckily, I received an email from Jennifer almost a month and a half or 2 months ago, something like that, talking about the Western Great Lakes BERT and BAT Observatory. And I was very intrigued because I had never heard of that organization before. When I saw the name Western Great Lakes, I thought, oh my gosh, I wonder where this is, and come to find out it's right here in Port Washington. So it's not something that's far away from us, and it's an organization that's doing great work on behalf of our native bird species and our bat species as well. Research, monitoring, education, and all kinds of things to support those populations, because as we know, those populations are having a great deal of difficulty for a number of different reasons. And Jennifer will be able to expand on that. But yeah, so that's why I wanted to have her on, so that people know about this organization and what they do and how they can get involved.
Very good. And my understanding is that your organization is about 10 years old. So in a sense, you have just or are about to celebrate your 10th anniversary, correct?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having me. It's been great talking with Nan. And I'm really looking forward to talking with you guys today.
Very good. Before we start talking about the Western Great Lakes BERT and BAT Observatory, tell us a little bit about where you come from, Jennifer, and maybe where your interest in the natural world and specifically birds and bats originated.
Yeah, so I grew up on Lake Huron in Michigan, and most of my childhood was spent running around in marshes and volunteering as much as I could at a state park there called Bay City State Recreation Area. And I did that basically from when I was 11 through when I graduated and came back on summers and kept helping out with there. And it just really taught me that I loved education, I loved science, I loved all of that and how it related to the natural world. But at the heart of it, it was really about birds, and I loved looking at them, chasing them, just understanding them. And so when I went to college, I got at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon, I got my bachelor's in biology. It's a really small school. That's really all you study if you're interested in birds. And then I took a year off, chased some more birds across the country with a bunch of different internships, and then ended up at the University of California, Davis for my PhD, where I studied bird coloration and how that's affected by climate and climate change. And then after that, I really was missing the Midwest. I love the Midwest. I love the Great Lakes. So I got a job at the EPA down in Chicago, and I spent 3 years working there, working on pollution issues, actually in southeastern Wisconsin. And then when this job came up, I just thought it would be a perfect fit. I was loving Wisconsin. I loved working there. And then it combined with all of my love for birds. So it was just kind of a perfect fit.
Fantastic. Sounds like it. Before we go any further, I have to have you circle back to your graduate school studies and specifically what you were exploring. Did you say bird coloration and how they change? Tell us just a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I studied a really obscure pattern in birds. It's called Gloger's Rule. It's a pattern of birds and some other organisms being darker in areas of higher humidity and precipitation. And nobody before that point had studied it really quantitatively. So that's what I did and looked at basically 100 different species of birds in the United States and looked at how they varied in this pattern and how it was related to climate statistically. Because before that, it was pretty much people just looking at birds saying like, oh, these two birds, one's darker, one's lighter. And so I tried to get into the nitty gritty of why. And there's still a lot of questions out there, so I can't give you the definitive answer, but I measured a lot of birds and got some more data than other people had. And hopefully people continue that work and try to figure out more about it.
So let's learn about now the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory. And remind us, Jennifer, how long you've been there?
2 years.
Very good. So tell us about how, under what circumstances and by whom the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory was founded.
So Noel Cutright, who was an amazing birder, and it looks like from Nan's nodding that she probably knows him personally, so she might be able to give more background on Noel. He founded the observatory about 10 years ago and started with finding a steering committee. He founded that and then brought in Bill Miller, who was the previous director before me, and formed the observatory originally at Forest Beach as part of that project, Forest Beach Migratory Preserve, where we used to be founded, or we used to have our headquarters, and was really part, he was instrumental in that project and had a vision of the two being together. Now, 3 years ago, we became our own 501c3 after being part of the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust as they were our fiduciary. And then at that time, also the clubhouse at Forest Beach, they disconnected the power. So we moved into the new offices also right when I started in downtown Port Washington. So we still work a lot with Land Trust, but we're two different entities now. But all of it was part of Noel's vision. And Bill was a friend of Noel's and continued that process over after Noel died, after forming the observatory and the preserve.
Very good. Nan, is there anything else you want to add about the man responsible for founding the observatory?
Just quickly, Noel Cuthright was considered one of the sort of greatest birders and bird champions, certainly in Wisconsin and, you know, other parts elsewhere. And so he did great good on behalf of habitat and our native bird species, both year-round and migratory bird species. So it's good to hear that he was involved in this. I also just wanted to say, circling back a little bit to what Jen said right in the beginning about why was this bird a darker color compared to other of its kind that weren't? And that's what science is all about. It's why. Why is that happening? Because in the natural world, there's always a reason for something happening. It's usually not just a random, you know, thingamajig that's happening. So, yeah, I mean, that's why science is so beautiful. You look at something and you say why, and then you go down the paths toward hopefully finding that answer. And it may take, you know, thousands of years to figure out that answer, but eventually somebody will.
Right. Yes. And of course, in some cases, the question of why and the answer of why might be a matter of life and death. I mean, it might not just be for the simplest and most pleasant of reasons, like our own curiosity, but also sometimes because there is urgent importance in understanding why something is happening, especially when something bad is happening. So,
excellent point. Yes, that's correct.
So, Jennifer, one of the things that intrigues me, and I think it would be a good point of clarification, is to find out why your organization is called an observatory, in part because I think there are interesting connotations with that word, where it kind of suggests that what it is more than anything is maybe this building where, you know, somebody goes if they want to observe birds or bats. And of course, I don't think you're using really the term in that way at all. In what way is the term observatory being used in this instance?
So the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory has been transitioning because we are a very small organization. So we've always been one full-time and one half-time person. So we're really small. So we have to think about really intentionally about where we put our resources. And we've been evolving to try to figure out what's the best, most efficient use of time and money to study birds the most effectively. And so one way we're doing that keeps true to that observatory mindset of understanding, watching birds, seeing how things are going or they're moving, is to actually use MODIS wildlife tracking system instead of traditional banding methods. So MODIS is basically a system of tiny transmitters on birds, so that when birds go past a receiver that is on the landscape, that data is sent to the tower and then sent to scientists like me, scientists all across in the entire system. So hundreds of researchers use this system and all the data is shared. So what we found is like traditional observatories often band birds and have land on which they band and observe dew point counts. We put our resources into expanding MODIS because that's how you can get more interceptions than finding one bird that has a band on it in the whole world, versus these towers have pretty large ranges. So what we're doing is trying to create a network of towers in Wisconsin and support other people doing that across the country and across the Western Hemisphere. And it basically just really increases the amount of data scientists can have without relying as heavily on labor-intensive methods like banding. And that's kind of the reason we've kind of transitioned to what we think of as modern observatory methods. And it's not to say traditional observatories don't collect great data. They really do. It's just we don't have the, we had to make choices of what we have the manpower to do. And this is a way we can still collect that data meaningfully and have higher efficiency at doing it.
Right. I saw information about this on your website and it looked really interesting. So just to clarify for our listeners, we're talking about something called MOTUS, spelled MOTUS. Can you tell us a little more about, kind of technologically speaking, how it works? And what is it that do you have to do something with a particular bird in order for it to be picked up by this system and tracked? And what is it that you do?
Yes, so this is a system run by Birds Canada. So they are kind of the lead for the entire world of MODIS, literally, because there are towers or receivers. I might use those two words interchangeably because most of ours are small towers, but receivers can look a little bit different in different areas. But basically they're coordinating, trying to expand this network across the entire world. And at the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory is trying to expand it in Wisconsin. So we kind of have a little chunk that we're trying to help people expand MODIS in. And what I am saying when I say expand MODIS, what I'm saying is trying to expand these receivers a network of receivers across the Wisconsin. And right now we're focusing a lot on the Lake Michigan corridor, where we know a lot of birds are funneled along. So what happens is a scientist catches a bird and puts a little tiny transmitter on them. And it emits a radio signal. And when a bird flies past a receiver, that signal is emitted to the receiver. And then the data about what bird that is and where it was previously intercepted is logged. And then when we download the data, we upload it to the system that Birds Canada has. And then any scientist anywhere can use that data. But the other thing that's cool, what I find really exciting about it, is anyone can use that data. So it can be used for education. It can be used just by anyone who wants to know where birds in their area are coming from. So it's one of those really exciting things. Like, for example, we have a tower in Port Washington that has birds coming from British Columbia and from Churchill, Canada. And like, they just come from all over these really far away places. And we know these birds are making huge migrations. We know they are doing that, but it resonates more knowing that this specific bird was tagged for this study. And then it came here, it came to Port Washington, or it came to, we also have a few towers farther north along Lake Michigan too. So knowing that like these places that we like going up to Two Rivers, I like to travel up there. Apparently some of our birds like to go up there too. So it's a really interesting thing to think about and exciting.
Yeah. So you're tracking, in a sense, the migratory pathways of for a given bird. Where did it start? Where did it go from there? And so on. Are you also tracking, in a sense, the rate of migration? That is, how fast they're traveling, how often they stop, for how long do they stop? I mean, is it possible to gather information about that as well? And is that even meaningful or interesting to you as a scientist?
Yes, that is actually why we're trying. You hit the nail on the head. So if we understand exactly where they're stopping and how long they're stopping for, we can understand where is really critical to preserve. So if we know that a lot of birds are going to this area, this point that may or may not be protected, then we know either it needs more protection or maybe more restoration. And so if we have ideas about speed and how fast they can refuel effectively, then we can conserve those areas more effectively. And that's really important during migration, because we know that if birds take too much time refueling, they have more of a chance of bad things happening to them. So either getting eaten by predators or finding other hazards. So what we want them to do is find great areas, fuel up quickly, and continue on their journeys. So we want to understand that pattern as much as possible so that we can protect them.
Mm-hmm. That could make an enormous difference for the better. That's really exciting. So are we talking about particular species that about which you are especially interested? I mean, what kind of birds are we really talking about here, in which you are gathering the most and most interesting data?
So most of what we do is help other folks. So what was really exciting this year is one of our collaborators, who's also on the leadership team with me on the Midwest Migration Network, she was tagging golden-winged warblers, which are a species of conservation concern in Wisconsin and nationally. And one of their larger breeding populations is in northern Wisconsin. So she was tagging golden wings up there, and the towers in southern Wisconsin were some of the ones that got the first interceptions of those birds. So starting to understand what the orientation of those birds is, which was really exciting, especially since we still need to learn a lot about how these guys migrate in order to protect them. And we know they're declining really significantly. So that was really exciting, especially because it's kind of a hometown bird. It's like the Wisconsin, like it's one of the bird. A lot of our declining birds breed farther north in Wisconsin. So they breed in the boreal forest or farther north. So we see them during migration. But the golden wings, they breed here, they migrate through here. They kind of, before they migrate into Central and South America. So it's just really exciting to be collecting that data about a bird that's right here in Wisconsin and is declining.
Fascinating. For those of you just joining us, our guest today on the morning show with Nan Calvert is Jennifer Phillips Vandenberg, PhD, Science Director for the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, located in Port Washington. And as we have just been hearing, one of the things that they do quite actively via this new technology called MOTIS is to track migrating birds and to gather enormous amounts of information and share it freely. And Jennifer, I'm assuming that this trade of information, you know, kind of flows in various directions. Are you also in the business of collecting that kind of information and doing something with it? Or are you more involved in the other end of the equation in the gathering of the information and sending it out to others who are going to in turn then really study it?
Right now, we're mainly in the expanding receivers in Wisconsin business. That's our biggest, we hope that soon we'll be in a place to collect data that we can use ourselves to study local populations. But right now, the big hurdle is having enough receivers in Wisconsin to be able to ask those questions. So right now, it's a lot of grant writing. It's a lot of trying to figure out how to get these towers funded and get more on the landscape. So right now, that's kind of our first step. But the next step is definitely tagging birds and trying to figure out where they're going in Wisconsin. So right in our area, we can help support them.
So right now, where are their receivers? I mean, how many and where are they? And how many more do you think we need in order for this to be done more effectively?
So in an ideal world, what we're trying to do is have kind of these fence lines of receivers. So one along Lake Michigan, which is our priority one right now, then one along the Mississippi, where we know a lot of birds migrate along, and then three kind of east-west lines throughout the state. So if you're a researcher here, you'd have a really good chance of being able to track them as they move south and follow the lake or the Mississippi River. So that's kind of where we're heading right now. We have a few people who had the money and vision to put them out along those locations, but it kind of looks like a smattering right now. But there's one down in the Driftless region near the Mississippi. Madison Audubon put one up north of Madison at their sanctuary at Goose Pond. There's one at the Milwaukee Zoo. And that one you can see publicly. And they actually just did an article in their members newsletter about it, if people are on that list too, with some really awesome pictures of their receiver. There's one in Waukesha, and then one in Port Washington. That one's not open to the public. It's on a private landholder, and then up at Woodland Dunes. But we're working to expand. We're working to expand that right now. So fingers crossed, lots of grants pending to get this moving.
Right.
I'm curious to know how the transmitters are affixed to the birds. And also, I think it's interesting for people to know how are birds caught in order to be fitted with this device or tagged in some way?
Yeah, so there are a few methods for catching birds, but the most common is mist netting. So it's this very fine net that is hard for birds to see. Actually, in one of my jobs, we caught a person who wasn't paying attention. So I would also say it's sometimes hard for people to see them. So these very fine but strong nets. And when birds fly into them, they get caught, and then trained volunteers or staff come out and pull them, extract them from the net. And then a trained bander who has a banding permit from the bird banding lab. It's a part of the US Geological Survey. Will affix a band is most common. So a little aluminum band with numbers on it. So that's pretty much what all birds that are caught get. But then for MODIS, they also put on basically a little tiny harness. So it goes over the back, and then they have like little stretchy material that the best, sometimes it's even made out of this. Like what I think of it as is the, with kids' bracelets, kind of the elastic that goes over their hands. That, imagine that, and it kind of goes around the bird, around the legs of the bird, and then it attaches it to the back. So it sounds like it doesn't hold up. May not be the strongest, but it actually holds up for a very long time. And especially since some of these transmitters are solar powered now, it means that they can last a very long time. So which is really exciting for the stage in MODIS, is that we can get so much more data versus before it was really limited by the size of the battery, because there are regulations on how heavy things on birds can be so that they're safe and won't affect the bird very much. So you want them to be really light. And that's the exciting part about the solar panels, is they're teeny tiny little solar panels, and they're really light, but they last a long time. So we can get more data about where these birds are going for multiple migrations, which is really exciting.
That's fascinating. Approximately how many birds are fitted with the harness thus far, do you know?
I do not know. It's thousands. I'm sorry. I should know this, but it seems like every time I look on Birds Canada's website, it's gone up. And it actually isn't just birds. Most of our collaborators work with birds, but other researchers work with monarchs. They're actually light enough that you can put it on a monarch, or some of the larger dragonflies, and also bats. So different researchers are asking a lot of different questions about basically anything that migrates. You can put a transmitter on and see where they're going.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. I wanted to ask you about bats because, of course, you work for the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory. And is there anything that connects birds and bats except that they both fly? I mean, but otherwise, are we talking about bats that migrate the way birds do? And are you gathering information about that as well? Or are you interested in bats for other reasons?
So unfortunately, we don't do as much with bats. But the good news is, what helps birds also helps bats. So a lot of our birds depend on healthy insect populations, and so do bats. So while I haven't talked about this, the other big project that we have is called the Neighborhood Habitat Improvement Project, which is a project trying to get more native plants and more healthy landscapes into urban environments. And all of those actions that we're trying to get people to do for birds are also really good for bats, like reducing pesticide usage, planting plants that support insects. It means that they're supporting both birds and bats. So we don't do as much research with bats, but we're still trying to support their populations by working through education and working with communities.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jennifer Phillips Vanderberg, PhD, Science Director of the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory in Port Washington. Nan Calbert has invited Jennifer to the program as her monthly visit to the morning show, and we're talking about a lot of different things that the Western Great Lakes Observatory is involved in. I know that something else that is important to you and important to the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory is something called the Neighborhood Habitat Improvement Project. And of course, this probably speaks to the heart of some of the issues that are leading to the decline in bird populations all across the country, actually. Tell us about this particular project and its main purpose.
So right now we're piloting this project in Port Washington with hopes that we'll be expanding it soon. We're working on figuring out new partnerships to expand, hopefully in the next year or two. But basically the purpose of the project is trying to make it easy to do things to help birds. So a lot of it comes down to reducing pesticide usage, herbicide usage, supporting pollinators that also in turn feed birds, and planting native plants that support insects and birds, and trying to make it easy, because what we know as scientists is that these actions are necessary to help minimize some of the impacts humans are having. But no matter how much scientists say that it's what's necessary, we know that it's not happening just from telling people. So instead, we're trying to build systems that make it easier for a community to change. So things that we're trying in Port Washington are reduced price plant sales that are in the community, because we surveyed people and found out that in Port Washington, a lot of people don't know where to get native plants. So we brought the native plants to them, reduced the prices, made it a little easier, offered education about how to care for these things, because that was another thing they told us in the survey, that they were concerned that they didn't know how to care for them. And the good news is they're usually pretty easy to take care of. So it was a pretty easy education as far as education goes. And then we're also trying different, we're one of the biggest predictors of how people plant their yards is what other people are doing. So we're starting an ambassador program where people who are already interested in native plants can show what their native plants look like, and show that it's not scary. And this is an approachable thing, even if it's just starting with one or two plants and then seeing if you're comfortable expanding. So we really are trying to make it visible, noticeable, and easy to plant native plants and do other actions. Mm-hmm. So this year, we're super excited to be partnering with the YMCA and Rotary Club to be putting in lots of native plantings up at the YMCA that will be public. They have a walking path there, so hopefully more people will see that. And we do similar stuff with the city. So trying to get it more visible so people can see this and see maybe this will be a good fit for their yards too, and offering these workshops to try to make it as easy as possible and reduce those barriers.
Now I understand why when I brought up your website, one of the first things I saw was something about a native plant sale. And
yes.
I didn't stop to think about it enough to sort of come up with what the connection could possibly be. It makes all the sense in the world. So Nan, you're the best expert I know of when it comes to native plants. So maybe you can talk for a bit about why this connection matters so much and what a difference the presence of native plants in a landscape can mean in terms of attracting birds and giving them something to eat.
So I always say that native plants are the intercessors between earth and sky, because they connect all of the flying things with everything below. You know, the jury is in, the verdict is in. Native plant landscapes are the thing that we need in order to heal the wounds we've inflicted, to support our native birds and bats and insects and everything else, because they form the basis of the food chain that supports insects. And insects are really the underpinning of the food chain for so many, many things. We also need native plants because they pollinate. And our native pollinators are extremely efficient little machines, if you will, in pollinating even food that we eat. Upwards of $3 billion annually of fruit crops that we eat. So without native plants, we can't have this. It's like the engine that drives the car. And so that's why I'm always going on and on about, you know, begin replacing your turf grass with native plants, whether it's a flowering plant, it's a shrub, a tree, a vine, anything and everything in the native world of plants, because those pieces are essential in the puzzle of life. We've removed so much of it. And that's in part why so many things are having great difficulty. So, I mean, really seriously, the best thing you can do for water quality and restoring the water cycle, the best thing you can do for butterflies, birds, bats, all of them, is put in native plants. They really are the thing that we need the most at this point.
So it sounds like what the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory is doing is trying to make it easier for people to find native plants and giving them reassurance that it isn't all that much of a challenge to plant them and raise them and so on. So here closer to home, where are people supposed to find native plants?
Well, you know, I'm always happy to be asked that question, because Wisconsin kind of, in a sense, is the birthplace of native landscaping. Way back in the 70s, the great Lori Otto realized that if she was going to have healthy birds and everything else, they needed the things that they looked to for nesting material and nectar and insects and everything else. And so that movement and that philosophy was launched way back in the 70s. And as a result, we have quite a number of native plant propagating nurseries. And I think the first one really is Prairie Future Seed Company. Just Google Prairie Future Seed Company. You know, I always tell people, patronize those businesses that actually propagate their own native plants. And we have so many of those in Wisconsin. And if you go to the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network website, click on the Go Native button, we have a list of native plant propagating firms and also other firms that are very reputable dealers in native plants. I want to give a plug to the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory Native Plant Sale. But locally here in Racine and Kenosha, all you have to do is order plants from the Root River Area Chapter of Wild Ones. Their native plant sale is going on now. It's really easy. All you have to do is order online. There's one central pickup place. Just go to the Wild Ones website, click on chapters, and scroll down to the Root River Area Chapter. Click on that, and you'll be able to access their online ordering. It's easier than ever. And most of the Wild Ones chapters throughout the state have their own native plant sales coming. They're popping up now. This is the time of native plant sales. Many of our nature centers have plant sales, like Hawthorne Hollow. MMSD, Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, has a plant sale specifically geared toward rain gardens, another excellent thing that people can do to support water quality and diversity of life. So there are so many places now that you can get native plants that are real bona fide native plants, not cultivars.
Very good. Thank you for that information.
You're welcome.
Jennifer Phillips Vanderberg, I noticed on the website for Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory an interesting event that I think occurred last October, which was called the Big Sit, that the observatory at least collaborated in. Can you tell us what happens or happened at the Big Sit?
Yes, yeah, so these are events. So we hold one in collaboration with Birding Group in the area, but they're everywhere. So if you get involved in bird clubs, a lot of them have big sits. But basically the idea is you get a group of people to a location and you sit and watch birds. So it's a really far afield name, but at, for the observatory, we've done it for years at Forest Beach Migratory Preserve at the Hawk Tower there. And as part of the tradition that Noel started, and then Bill Miller continued, and through this long series of different people doing it, we're continuing that tradition up there, collecting data of everything that people can see in that one day at that, during those hours. And we'll be having it, or I can't imagine why we wouldn't have it again this year. We're planning for another one this year out at Forest Beach. Anyone's welcome. And it's another great way to learn about birds. So don't feel like you have to know it all to come out and learn from other people. There are a bunch of our board members did it this year, and they're wonderful people to learn from. So the best way to learn birding is to get with people who already know it and are patient with you. And those guys, I can guarantee, are really patient with people. I do not have the best bird ear. There's a reason I studied bird coloration, not song. So they're even patient with me. So I appreciate, that's a great way to learn. And we do have bird tours also led by some of those same folks that are great ways to learn too. If anyone wants to come up and look at birds in Port Washington or Ozaukee County broadly.
I noticed in the information about the Big Sit that they made a point of saying that that this is a non-competitive event.
Yes.
Which, of course, underscores the fact that there are some people who are bird watchers who are competitive bird watchers and really
yes.
out for the big numbers, and that's not really the spirit of this event at all.
No. There, we do also some years we've had a birdathon team. We haven't for a couple of years, but we still support people who do this. Like in Wisconsin, the Natural Resource Foundation, which also is just a great group of people, both fundraising and then giving grants to other nonprofits. They hold a birdathon specifically to raise money for their bird protection fund, which funds bird conservation in Wisconsin. And what that is competitive. So there are some of these running more competitive events running around. I think those are also really fun to be a part of, but it's a different mentality than just a low key day watching birds out on sitting around with some birders.
Right.
So it's a different feel, but I totally recommend if you're interested in a little more competitive, NRF has a great birdathon. They're great. It's a great organization. They also help fund some of our work. So definitely I support getting out there and raising money for birds.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I know that also, at least via your website, there's a series of webinars that touch on a lot of different topics. And I suspect that as the science director for the observatory, you probably have a very direct hand in the creation, a lot of that content. Tell us the kind of things that are offered up in your webinar series.
So 90% of them are really about things people can do to make the landscape more friendly for birds, insects, and water quality. That's 90%. And then the last 10% is just things we think people would like. So I gave a talk about bird coloration, like the science of bird coloration. But most of them are like benefits of native plants, how native plants can solve problems in your yard. And we're having someone from the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District that Nan mentioned. They're giving one on the benefits of rain gardens and how to get started. We have a bunch of different ones. Somebody's coming from this year. They're coming to talk about bird hazards that people sometimes unintentionally have. And she's a rehabilitator and gets to see how this happens every day. So we have a series of different topics, hopefully that are interesting, but also hopefully give people information that they can act on to reduce hazards to birds and learn a little bit along the way. And if people are interested in any of these topics, native plant related or bird hazard related, all of our previous ones are online. And you can, if you search for the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory on YouTube, we have a channel and you can learn about all of this stuff. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us and we can provide more information about any of the topics that were talked about.
Wonderful. It's been great to learn about the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, and we certainly hope that your hopes and dreams for expansion can come true, so your good work can continue and continue on an even wider scale. Jennifer Phillips Vandenberg, the Science Director for the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, it's been great to meet you today, and I appreciate the time that you took to share all this information with us and our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Nan Calvert, I think you have a couple of announcements before we sign off.
I definitely have a couple of announcements. On April 30th, from 9 in the morning until noon at the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, there will be a really interesting offering called Experiencing Spring Through Senses and Science, a Phenomenology Journey. So you're going to explore the setting of the EcoJ using a science and sense-based nature observation method with two science educators. And you'll be drawing from science curricula from the Waldorf Steiner schools across the world. And they'll explore things like heating and cooling, hydrology, morphology of plants and animals. And they will investigate firsthand as you walk the property and observe trees, streams, and the forest floor. The cost is $25, and all you have to do is go to the Eco Justice Center's website to register. Now, on March 22nd, World Water Day will be observed, and this is very important for people to key into. It's kind of long past the time that we need to key into it, but their theme this year is groundwater, making the invisible visible. And of course, you know, at Reed Pike Watershed Initiative Network, we talk a lot about groundwater. To get people to become aware of that we have groundwater and what we can do about it. And so if you go to the website, worldwaterday.org, you can find all different kinds of information and education. There's a really cool one-minute challenge you can take. So World Water Day is March 22nd. Also on that day, March 22nd through May 4th, Reed Pike Watershed Initiative Network is having a rain barrel fundraising sale. The sale goes live on March 22nd. You can get the web address from our website, and you can order a rain barrel or two or three, depending upon what you need. Part of the proceeds go to support Reed Pike Winds programs. The rain barrel will be delivered directly to your door, and having a rain barrel is one of the things that you can do to help protect and preserve groundwater and water quality in general. And so also don't forget to patronize the Root River Area Chapter of Wild Ones Native Plant Sale that is going on now and get those native plants into your landscapes.
Very good. Thank you, Nan Calvert, for all of the information, and thank you for inviting Jennifer Phillips Vandenberg to be our special guest today on The Morning Show here on WGTD. We'll see you in April. The Morning Show airs every weekday